I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On this episode of the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, we're going to be talking with Dr. Cassandra Gibson. Dr. Gibson is an associate professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Nutritional Sciences at the University of Kentucky. She's going to be talking with us today about the adulterant in the opioid supply, xylazine.
Dr. Cassandra Gibson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're really excited to have you. Our topic for the day is, just really timely. And so we're just really excited to be able to get you to carve out some time out of your busy schedule to have us let us have this conversation with you. At the beginning of every episode, we like to have a little bit of a conversation around your background and training to help our audience know a little bit about your perspective and a little bit about your journey of how you made it to where you are. And so if you wouldn't mind maybe telling us a little bit about your training history.
Sure. So I actually did my undergraduate degree in experimental psychology at the University of California, San Diego. And that was in 2004. And then I went to the University of Kentucky and got my PhD in experimental psychology with Dr. Michael Bardo. And then I ended up going to a postdoctoral scholarship for 5 years at the Department of Neuroscience at the Medical University of South Carolina. After that, I started my lab in 2015. And that was at Arizona State University. And then I moved my lab to the University of Kentucky in 2020, where I was promoted to associate professor.
There's like these patterns that happen as we do these episodes. And it's been a little bit since we've had the UCSD connect in a while, but there's a large footprint in the field there, and MUSC as well. And then shout out ASU. That's where I went to undergrad.
Nice.
And I'm from Phoenix, so.
Okay.
I think it'd probably be pretty challenging to do your work at ASU, and so being at UK makes a lot more sense. Also, just Kentucky is just like the world leader in this, behavioral pharmacology space.
Yes.
In like Johns Hopkins and so forth. And so, I'm really excited for you to have you on today to talk about these kinds of things, and just awesome training history.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you've really spent some time, I think, in some top departments in our field. And yeah, as Noah said, I think we've had a few people with the University of Kentucky connection come on, and I've just been thrilled by the episode, so I'm very, very excited about this one. And I guess we'll sort of move into that space. Today we'll be talking about, you've had a lot of, I think, really compelling research, but some of your more recent work has been on this emerging issue of xylazine, also called Trank, which has emerged as an adulterant in the drug supply. We thought this was a really pertinent issue for our listeners to learn about, and for ourselves to learn about, actually. We're very excited about this. We're wondering if you could just give us start off by sort of giving us a little bit of an overview. What is this, maybe pharmacologically, what's going on? And we'll start there.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the opioid drug supply has evolved in terms of what has been found as an adulterant. And we actually know that fentanyl has replaced heroin in the drug supply within the United States. And that really changed the severity of the disorder for patients and also presented challenges with treatment. And this is because fentanyl is stronger than heroin and acts differently in the body. And then we've also come to learn that since around 2010, another drug has really started to be detected being mixed with fentanyl, as you mentioned, xylazine. So xylazine is a veterinary medication. It's used for surgical procedures in animals, but it's not approved for human use. So in animals, it's used, like I said, during surgical procedures, typically in combination with other drugs such as ketamine. And the goal of xylazine is really to reduce the amount of those other drugs like ketamine that's needed to achieve the surgical plane of anesthesia. But it's really not clear what it does when it's combined with fentanyl in humans.
Hmm.
So in term you asked about the pharmacology. Xylazine actually exists in a family of compounds, including lefexidine or Lucemyra, and also clonidine. So lefexidine is FDA approved for the treatment of the clinical opioid withdrawal syndrome. And also clonidine is an antihypertensive medication that's and it's been approved since the 1960s for that indication, but it's been used off-label to treat opioid withdrawal for decades. And so all of these compounds are alpha adrenergic 2A receptor agonists.
So for us who are not behavioral pharmacologists, can you give us a little indication of like what that sort of means? How is it acting? And then maybe some of the effects, like, in animals, it's been used as an anesthesia. What's the profile in humans?
Like I mentioned, that this is not approved for human use. So we don't know much about xylazine side effects, but it does appear to change the experience of fentanyl in a way that makes it potentially more sedating and more toxic. So it's actually the use of xylazine is causing medical complications and challenges with successful treatment. These are including, but we don't know everything about it yet, but including tissue necrosis, and so skin wounds. And this can happen
Wow.
both at and outside of the injection site. And one of the issues that we have is that xylazine is adulterating the fentanyl supply. We know that because, fentanyl positive urine specimens are also xylazine positive. However, we don't know what mechanistically is causing, for example, skin wounds. Is it the xylazine itself, or is it some other aspect of the adulteration process? We just don't know. In terms
Interesting.
of, so the DEA published in 2022 a report where they talk about how individuals may be potentially seeking out xylazine because it could extend the high of fentanyl. However, that is a little confusing because it what we find and what I think has been consistent across what I've seen so far is that it actually decreases fentanyl intake, and also it's not a preferred adulterant. So 74% of individuals reported that they are not seeking out xylazine. And this is
Interesting.
actually consistent with my experience that I had recently. I was able to go to Johns Hopkins University and visit with Dr. Kelly Dunn and see patients who are experienced with opioids. And the individuals that I was able to speak with, they didn't know if they had ever been exposed to xylazine. But one individual reported that, they are very experienced with fentanyl, but a recent experience was that they fell asleep for a really long time after using fentanyl, which is a novel experience. And they thought maybe that could have been xylazine, but they just don't know. And one of the issues is that there is a overwhelming lack of data on self-reported use in both at-risk and general populations in terms of xylazine. And so we really don't know if people, number one, know that they've been exposed to xylazine, or if they are seeking it out, we don't know what really what proportion that is and why.
I wonder a little bit about like why it would make its way into the drug supply, especially if people aren't seeking it out, right? Like there wasn't, I think people were thinking that way about fentanyl originally, right? They were like, why is this? And then I think the more we've talked about it, the more obvious some of those reasons were. It's easy, it's more portable, it's smaller, right? Like you can really hide it and transport it and import it in ways that make that easier to make the drug supply, to make its way into the drug supply. Right. And so reminds me of back in the early 2000s, I used to work in a frontline treatment center for methamphetamine in Phoenix, which at that time was just a really big problem. And at the end of the line there, right before the meth kind of epidemic kind of quelled and we transitioned to more opioids, at least at the clinic I was working at, we started seeing people who were getting meth supply that had opioid in it.
Yes.
And part of that, the idea that people were speculating at that time was, not every drug supply person you were getting your meth from would be able to make your withdrawal syndrome change because of the tiny amount of opioid withdrawal that was mixed into the after effects of the meth, which means you had to go back to the same person to kind of get that. Was the idea that they were thinking behind it? It also could have just been like spill, right? In Phoenix, these are, big drug operations that have multiple substances in a single place, which is how fentanyl kind of cross-pollination or cross-contamination happens. And so I wonder, do we know any reason why somebody would be purposely putting this in, or do we think it's an accident?
From the reports that I have seen, and this is somewhat speculation on my part, so
Sure.
take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
So early DEA reports indicated that xylazine entered the drug supply from veterinary pharmaceutical sources and then added at the local level. And so it seems a little hard to imagine that that would have been accidental.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know. More recent reports are indicating that the xylazine supply has shifted overseas. So this is from a paper that came out last year from D'Orazio, where they actually, give some of the statistics that I hadn't seen before. And they actually noted that the DEA is estimating that xylazine powder is being purchased from Chinese suppliers, and then it's being detected in fentanyl tablets. So I'm not sure that it would be accidental
Yeah,
versus.
it sounds a little purposeful. Is there like a
Right.
pharmacological reason that combining those two substances would be like meaningful?
So there is an idea out there that it's prolonging the quote high of
Right.
fentanyl, but we don't have any data on that.
Yeah, okay.
And the fact that a majority of individuals who are using fentanyl are not seeking out xylazine makes me wonder if it's, really is extending the reinforce or increasing the reinforcing efficacy of fentanyl. You would potentially expect more people to be looking for it. But
Yeah.
again, there are a lot of potential reasons for that that we don't know. For example, again, kind of hearkening back to my experience in that outpatient clinic, it was really notable that individuals were reporting how much they missed using heroin, because
Yeah.
because they could use it in the morning and then go to work and be functional
Yeah.
all day, whereas with fentanyl, they have to be on a very regimented schedule where, 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m., they are using it throughout their workday. It seems to have a much shorter effect profile. And they also more subjectively were reporting that heroin felt like a warm hug from an old friend, but fentanyl doesn't have that. And so they actually
Oh.
reported missing that feeling. And so it
Interesting.
was a really interesting, not only how they report feeling while using these different opioids, but also it was interesting to note the different patterns of use throughout the day. And I think that's really an important aspect that we need to consider as well.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Also, because fentanyl administration alone is dangerous, right? Because it's really easy to like accidentally go a little too much. And so having to have more doses throughout the day presents more kind of pressure points for risk in a person. And I'm obviously just connecting dots that might not need to be connected. And so please correct me. But you said earlier that xylazine potentially has some opioid withdrawal effects.
Yes.
Was
So,
that right?
yes, there was a paper that came out last year from Spadaro that actually reported clinical experiences from Reddit. And I thought that was really interesting. There were a lot of quotes in there, but within that paper, they report that 50% of patients reported that xylazine use made withdrawal from other substances worse. And so, from my own work, which is, we use preclinical rodent models to kind of model the clinical experiences and kind of back translate to the preclinical level. What we actually found was that there was a very different withdrawal effect profile between males and females, and it was really protracted. And it was really exacerbated in females as well. Naloxone administration was ineffective at precipitating withdrawal. And so, you know, from there, we have since kind of tried to really figure out what could be related to the withdrawal syndrome and how it compares, like I mentioned, these other adrenergic 2A agonists, how it compares to drugs within that drug class that are not noted adulterants in the opioid supply.
Interesting. Yeah. And so that's kind of where I was thinking a little bit was, you know, maybe this is a similar patterning to the meth kind of thing that I talked about, that it would functionally change the experience of a person on the back end when they're, you know, motivated to purchase drugs or you know, acquire drugs that might facilitate a specific pattern, whether that be increased purchasing across the day, which it sounds like is true, at least with fentanyl broadly, right? That they, like heroin, they could do dose twice throughout the day, right? Where fentanyl, they're doing it six times just to make it through the day, which facilitates just a totally different purchase profile. But also that the withdrawal syndrome is changed in a way that makes it more challenging to manage, and thus facilitating. There are very few things more motivating to people than avoid getting sick at the end of a dose schedule. And so I wonder if it's following a similar pattern there. At least we don't know, it sounds like.
Right.
But there is at least, you know, some, you know, pharmacological evidence that it is not just changing the intoxication profile potentially, but also the withdrawal patterning. Such that it potentially would move people in specific directions, potentially, which would motivate somebody to adulter the drug with it. Whether that be the supplier themselves or you know, some kind of manufacturer along the way.
One other thing I want to mention about withdrawal and kind of treatment potentially of overdose is Narcan is a wonderful compound that is now over the counter, and that's fantastic. But one thing to note is that if someone is overdosing with fentanyl and xylazine present, Narcan, you know, will work to reverse fentanyl, but it won't pharmacologically reverse xylazine. And so even if it's working to reverse, you know, the effects of fentanyl, a patient can still appear extremely sedated from xylazine. And so that's why I think one of the really important things we need to focus on is finding xylazine reversal agents that could potentially be used as adjunct therapeutics to Narcan.
Wow. Yeah. Well, especially as the, you know, the, I think there was a 1000% increase in the presence of xylazine. I was trying to find
I believe it was 1100%
positive drug. Yeah.
Right. But one of the things I want to point out is that a lot of the data we have are from mortality, overdose mortality.
Right.
Data.
Right.
So
yeah, that's a good point.
I think it's really important to note, I don't want to say it's a limitation, but it is narrow, right? And what we know.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. And I think it sort of brings me, like, is there like a pretty high risk profile for xylazine alone? And do we think that it increases? I mean, in general, if someone took a high dose of xylazine, like what's the potential for overdose? And does it increase risk of overdose? For people who might be using fentanyl?
So that's a question that's a bit complicated. So from the data I've seen, and it's, I haven't seen anything published, so this is just, you know, some reported data, is that xylazine itself isn't widely used. That it's in animal models, I haven't seen evidence that it, you know, is working as a reinforcer, that animals don't self-administer it alone. I've tried to look in the literature for any clinical signals that xylazine has been utilized by itself, you know, and I have only seen maybe a case report where there was a potential suicide attempt, for example, but, you know, the patient was treated, you know. And so I don't, there really isn't much in the literature to support
that's totally
that.
Different than like someone, maybe using heroin for
Right.
euphoric effects. Yeah, right.
Right. And I would also just caution against making conclusions yet
Yeah.
about what is leading to the increase in overdose mortalities. We just don't know enough about what xylazine
Yeah.
is doing to the fentanyl, experience to know if it's the con, you know, how it's contributing, I guess would be what, how I would say that.
There's this element of this that is almost confusing, because there, you know, it has this similar profile to drugs that are actually being used to treat withdrawal. And yet it seems to be in some ways making things worse when it's being used, I guess, in combination with heroin. So
that's wild.
It's hard to sort of understand. Yeah.
Yeah. It would make sense to me, right? That like, if it helps with withdrawal, then adding it to the fentanyl would actually make the user's experience better, potentially, right? Like it could, maybe it would shave off some of the hard edges on the withdrawal, but it actually appears to be making things worse, which is very confusing.
Well, one thing I would say from a pharmacological perspective is that their pharmacological effect profiles are not identical. And so I think it's important to continue to do research on their differences down to the cellular, and signaling pathway levels, just to really figure out how they are different. And, that was part of the reason for our latest paper, was to, we have to start somewhere. So we started behaviorally. What can we do? And so if we can identify and define the effect profiles during, self-administration and during withdrawal, and get behavioral and biological outcome measures from these different, aspects of the experiment, how can we compare these different compounds? And so what we do is we actually have animals intravenously self-administer fentanyl, and we add xylazine to the infusion, or we can add other compounds such as lofexidine. And we can do a lot of different things with that. We've manipulated the dose of fentanyl. We've manipulated the dose of xylazine and really looked at behavioral effect profiles. And what's interesting is we saw some similarities and also some differences between xylazine and lofexidine when they are added to the fentanyl infusion. And I think those differences are really important to really dig down deep into.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about what you found?
Sure. So in terms of self-administration, what we did was we actually manipulated the fentanyl dose, and we also gave animals the opportunity to self-administer saline. So fentanyl was not present on those days, but xylazine or lofexidine were in the infusion. And what we saw was that across the board, whether it was saline or different doses of fentanyl, xylazine suppressed intake or the number of infusions the rats took, whereas lofexidine was unique in that it did not suppress saline, but it did suppress fentanyl intake. So those were some really big differences, because what we concluded was that xylazine may be generally suppressing behavior, potentially due to sedation, whereas lofexidine specifically is suppressing behavior. And then the other thing we looked at was withdrawal. And we saw some really interesting differences here. So when animals self-administer fentanyl with xylazine, we find clinical signals are profound sedation. They pretty much fall asleep. But then within a couple of minutes, they wake up and then they take another infusion. So what we saw when we looked at different time points from their last day where they were able to self-administer is we actually quantify their withdrawal signs. A lot of these are locomotion or activity based. And what we found is, compared to just fentanyl alone, animals that received the lofexidine or the xylazine combinations with fentanyl showed suppression of these withdrawal signs right after the session ended. But as you start to go out from that time point, we measured 12 hours later, 24 hours later, 48 hours later, what we actually saw was differences in the rebound of the withdrawal signs between those two different adulterant groups. And so this is really an important point, because the xylazine animals rebounded by 12 hours. In our prior paper, we found that the half-life of xylazine intravenously in rats was 0.88 hours or so. Lofexidine has a much longer half-life. And so in those rats, what we saw was that withdrawal sign rebound took longer. It wasn't until 24 hours later that we saw the rebound. And so this kind of makes sense if you think about how lofexidine is FDA approved to treat withdrawal, but it's not FDA approved to reduce intake of fentanyl. And so it's really important to be identifying the differences here and focusing on how lofexidine may be promising in treating withdrawal from, say, even xylazine. And so those are kind of the clinical messages we want to push forward. One thing that we always gather data on body weight because we control how much food the animals eat every day. And so we weigh them and we get their body weight. And we do this in all of our studies, but we'd never really examined it before. And so what we did was we plotted body weight across the entire experiment, which was about 30 days long. So during self-administration and during that acute withdrawal period. And what we found was that regardless of the adulterant in the fentanyl infusion, all rats lost a significant amount of body weight across the experiment, which I didn't realized was happening. And then when I looked into the literature, there are prior preclinical studies demonstrating body weight loss from opioids, from opioid exposure. And then there's also,
Do you know if this is like because the rat is eating less food, even though it's being given or
So I looked into the literature. I was going down a lot of rabbit holes when I saw this, but basically I was looking into the mechanistic literature on mu opioid receptors and adipose tissue and feeding behavior. And there's actually a pretty, I don't want to say old literature, but I don't know how to say that better. There's a large body of literature focusing on endogenous opioid mechanisms of feeding behavior, as well as how opioids themselves, which are, you know, mu opioid receptor agonists, alter feeding behavior. And so one thing that I noted from the literature is that there is increased appetite with chronic opioid exposure. And there's also the increase in feeding behavior sensitizes with repeated opioid exposure, and there's no evidence of tolerance to this effect. And it's, although it's unclear if xylazine is potentiating that effect, right? It's possible because there's also, if you want to look at the xylazine literature, it's mostly veterinary. And so I have kind of gone down literature searches in the veterinary literature. And what I found was studies from early 1980s found that when deer were given xylazine, they actually showed a decrease in appetite within 24 hours of that exposure. And so all of the signals are pointing to, you know, these compounds potentially altering feeding behavior. And mechanistically, in terms of body weight loss, we have no idea. But there are signals in the literature that compounds within this particular drug class have been evaluated as anti-obesity treatments. And you know, so there, and there's also one study which is Luba in 2023 that found that body mass index was associated with fentanyl clearance. And whereby a higher BMI is associated with slower fentanyl clearance. And so there are signals indicating that these things are related. And so I think this warrants a lot of research.
It sounds like what you're saying is that xylazine taken over and over again could result in weight loss, and that weight loss could result in actually like greater sensitivity to fentanyl?
We don't know. I can't speak to that.
Yeah.
The only thing I can speak to is that during the first 24 hours of withdrawal, we saw a very significant and exacerbated drop in body weight in the fentanyl and xylazine group.
Wow.
The fentanyl plus lofexidine group showed some body weight loss, but it wasn't significant in that first withdrawal day compared to fentanyl alone. And so there seems to be something there with the xylazine specifically. And we correlated the change in the somatic signs of withdrawal on that first day to the change in body weight at, during that same time period. And we did find a correlation. So the greater the rebound of withdrawal signs at the 24-hour time point, the more weight the animals lost. And so one of the things that we concluded from that, because we always keep clinical translation in our minds when we're doing these studies, is that what could, you know, individuals doing clinical research or even practitioners do easily with patients is take their body weight, right? And if we can dig deeper into this relationship between withdrawal severity and body weight loss, perhaps that could be a very easy to obtain clinical signal, right? That could be related to withdrawal. And so that's something that we want to continue to dig into the mechanisms of that. And so we're doing that in collaboration with the MPI on our grant. His name is Dr. Terry Hines. He's actually an expert in diabetes and obesity research. And so one of the benefits of having a collaborator who is, you know, has similar interests but is not directly in my expertise is that we can collaborate and get more information, right? Because when individuals are using fentanyl and xylazine, it's not just affecting the brain and it's not just affecting behavior, it's affecting the entire body, right? And so, in order to answer more questions about what this drug combination is really doing in people, I think we need to be crossing those field boundaries. And so,
That makes
that's
sense.
been really exciting for us.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point because there could be things, you know, you're focusing on the brain, but there could be things happening at sort of like a molecular level throughout the body that could
Right.
be informing and influencing this. And yeah, this marker seems really important. It actually also just sounds like clinically, this would increase the risk profile of someone who was using fentanyl because just, you know, body weight loss over time it can be associated with some pretty severe things.
Right. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about what a new postdoc in my lab has been doing, Dr. Krista Corley. She took over this project in September, and one thing she wanted to do, so let me backtrack just a little bit, and I promise it's relevant to the to this conversation.
We believe you.
is I so I've been mentioning all of these studies we've been doing, but we've been using fairly short access sessions, meaning rats only get 2 hours a day to self-administer the drug, right? And so one of the issues with that is if you remember that I mentioned individuals are using the drug throughout the day in specific intervals. So what we wanted to do was give the animals more time during the day to self-administer the xylazine fentanyl combination and look at patterns of behavior and intake during 6 hours instead of two. And then we also are getting other biological outcome measures, including blood glucose levels. And the reason I wanted to do that is because there are reports, again, in the veterinary literature that xylazine acutely induces hyperglycemia in rats. And also, this isn't from any data I've seen published, but I went to a webinar that mentioned in, I think, emergency rooms, maybe. There were just some surprising reports of changes in blood glucose in patients that were xylazine positive. And so, with that, we actually just went ahead and took those measures. So, what we did was we did a blood glucose measurement at baseline. So, these animals were drug naive. And then they went through 1 hour access of fentanyl alone to train. After about a week, we then transition them to 6 hour sessions with just fentanyl by itself or fentanyl with xylazine in the infusion. And what we found was that after that, those 1 hour sessions only, right? 1 hour a day, we actually found hypoglycemia in our rats. And then after the 6 hour sessions of fentanyl alone, that level remained static. So they were still in a hypoglycemic state, but it wasn't worse. When we added xylazine to their infusions, what was really fascinating was that the blood glucose levels not only shot up, you know, but they shot past their baseline level. So now we're seeing this hyperglycemia after our 6 hour xylazine and fentanyl sessions. And so we are going to be looking into the mechanisms of that. And like I mentioned, Dr. Terry Hines, he's an expert in adipose tissue function and liver function, and he can actually get to the signaling mechanisms of that. And I think that's really important because Dr. Kelly Dunn had a paper perhaps last year talking about the metabolism and excretion patterns of fentanyl and how it's unique because it is stored in adipose tissue and can be released throughout withdrawal. And so I think it's really important to look at how adipose tissue function might be changing and how that can really affect other system body systems.
That's very interesting. Yeah, so it sounds like across all of these things, in some way, shape, or form, xylazine in combination, when you could do these kind of controlled dosing schedules, that it changed several things in the kind of acute withdrawal phase for these animals. Where, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounded like you said that like the immediate after effects in the withdrawal phase, the early phase of withdrawal was maybe like less terrible, and then but then it had a rebound later,
Correct.
right? And maybe some of the mechanisms that are working there are the way that it's affecting all these different types of blood sugar systems and things like this. And it would make sense, I guess, just from like a big picture issue, that if it was really changing that like early phase of the withdrawal syndrome for fentanyl, that it would, adding it to the drug supply would have meaning, right? That it could potentially be doing something for somebody somewhere along the way, that they would be doing this on purpose. Even if it's, maybe it's making the fentanyl less terrible in the immediate aftermath, but producing more motivated behavior towards use later because of the rebound effect, or something like this. That would be really interesting,
Right.
kind of pharmacology, if that makes sense.
I just don't think we know enough yet about, what people's motivations are when it comes to xylazine. And so I would hesitate to speculate about what the long-term motivation would be for individuals.
I mean, it sounds like this is so emergent, and I've always I've never done preclinical research, but it's always been sort of fascinating to me in a way, because of how much control you can have, how elegant the designs can be. And it sounds like you all are just in the midst of a very complicated puzzle that's a maybe a part of the way solved, and you're getting some of the information. And yeah, it's really cool to hear about this sort of frontline work.
And that I kind of breezed over how we look at the brain, which I don't mean to underemphasize it. We are looking at brain mechanisms as well. And this is also in collaboration with Dr. Hines because he has this cutting edge technology that only a few labs in the country have. It's called a PAM gene PAM station, and it allows him to identify functional changes in targets. They're called kinases. He's mapping what's called the kinome of specific brain areas that we think are important. And we can look at how the fentanyl and xylazine combination uniquely changes that. And the really nice thing about that is it gives you a very long list of potential targets, right? So we pick the ones that are the most changed and then, try to pharmacologically target them. But we have quite a long list to start with.
Well, and that sort of leads, I think, us into something we wanted to talk about, that you may not have very many answers for now, but we're starting to, we're clinically focused. We're thinking about like, well, what do we do about this? Like, I think on an individual level and on a public health level. And so I'm wondering, you've mentioned a few things, like, at least in terms of thinking through what kind of targets we want to look for, like, finding a reversal agent, so that it can be added with something like Narcan, which seems like that would be a really important thing to do. Are there any other emerging, treatments, or with this list, are there sort of things in the works to have those individuals, and then the public health level too, if you could speak to that. That was a large question, so I apologize for throwing it all at you. Yeah.
No worries. I have quite a lot of thoughts. So you'll have to stay tuned for your first question because we have the kinome mapped of some brain areas, and we do have some top targets, but we have to run the experiments to see if they're viable. And we're also continually collecting data on other tissues as well to figure out what xylazine is doing within and beyond the brain, right? And so our hope is that we will have some data in the next year or two to speak to that. So you'll have to stay tuned.
Yeah.
In terms of public health, I think it's really important, number one, that we recognize that this is not the first adulterant of the illicit opioid
Yeah.
supply. This is the current one. And so although, you know, we've been digging our heels deep to try to figure out what xylazine is doing, we need to be forever, you know, ears open to what is happening in terms of actual use trends across the country. And so one thing I want to mention is the National Drug Early Warning System, because I think those are the tools that we need to be leveraging to get ahead of this. We weren't ahead of the game when fentanyl took over for heroin, and that has led to a horrible public health crisis. And so here again with xylazine, we're not ahead of it, right? And so I think that if we put more resources into these surveillance endeavors, we could really start to at least catch up with, if not get ahead of, these emerging adulterants.
Yeah.
And then one other thing I want to mention is that, you know, beyond just surveillance, I think that we should be putting our resources into very readily available drug testing
Yeah.
strips that individuals in the community can readily obtain. And it should just become common to test the drug, right? To see what invisible adulterants might be in the drug supply. So that's another thing. And then also just focusing our efforts on understanding people's experiences and getting more self-report of that is really important so that
Yeah.
we can really understand the clinical experience. And then one thing that I want to mention is I had the opportunity at this group called Cure Addiction Now in September to speak with just community members in Los Angeles. And it was a really unique experience because I don't really ever do that, right? I don't have these opportunities to speak
Yeah.
with community members. And one thing that I took away from it was that none of them had ever heard of xylazine. And so it made me wonder if we shouldn't be putting our resources into dissemination of knowledge that we have that, you know, is not getting out to everybody in the community. And
Yeah.
so I do think that with the White House and the DEA issuing urgent public health alerts about xylazine, that did help with, for example, news coverage of xylazine, but not everybody is watching that. And
Absolutely.
so I think that if we have monetary support for programs that will educate people, especially in underserved populations, that would really go a long way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting an issue that we have more generally in science with human populations, which is the people who engage with us are probably it's there's like it's a selected group. They opt in to engagement. And we may not be even remotely close to understanding the experiences of a lot of people who are just in sort of a different circle that we are not reaching, that aren't looking at the news, that aren't engaged in research. That's a really important point, that there's not really a good answer for. How do you make contact with someone who, we haven't made contact with before, essentially?
So one thing that through my experiences in grant review, which is kind of a random reference, but I reviewed grants for a specific program that had something called a community engagement plan. And what was really important was not just I'm going to go to conferences and present the research, but going into their communities to disseminate their science to school systems, to, you know, their neighborhoods. And those were really strong engagement plans. And I think that if we kind of keep that in our minds, it's not easy to talk to the general public, especially if you are a preclinical person who, you know, I work with rats, I study the brain. It's challenging to come up with verbiage that, you know, can be understood. And so I think that if we practice it, and if that just becomes a part of our regular activities, I think that we would do it, get a lot further.
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely critical component, and that's a great way to do it. I think it's sort of it's like you don't know what you don't know, or you don't know who you're not reaching if you don't know who you're not reaching. And so there still could be people but that's a step beyond what I think anyone in science has really been doing very well for the last 40 years. And it is a growing trend, and I think that I think as a grant reviewer, it's really nice to hear, actually, because I would hope that would be integrated into where, you know, the only thing that's really going to make change is you change, you know, the reporting requirements for funding, essentially. And if that's a part of the expectation, then that, I think there will be a lot more dissemination.
Yeah. Not to add another section for people to have to write, but it just seemed really exciting.
Right. There are too many sections already. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway.
We could probably merge it with another section. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. But it's not something we're trained in either. I think and I think even integrating it into either graduate level classes or you know, whatever it is.
Well, one thing that we have a training grant here run by, it's co-run by Craig Rush and Bill Stoops. One thing that they do is they have community members who with lived experience who actually spend time with our graduate students and postdocs, and they present together. And it's really, I think, a unique and exciting experience.
Yeah. One of the things that I think make the group at University of Kentucky doing this research, like, I think, just sort of a step above. It's just really phenomenal. And you all always seem to have your ear really close to the ground, really understand and know about these trends. And going back to, I think, what you mentioned, it's when we sort of experience public health crises, crises in general, as these things that are emergent and that we need to rush to fix. It's easy to miss the trends that you described, that this early detection warning system is picking up on or could pick up on, and to understand why and the patterns. And that's sort of a study in and of itself. Like, we, you know, there's this, you know, this behavioral pharmacology and understanding what's happening at the individual level. But there are these trends going on that I think we just need to do a lot better job of, like you're mentioning, developing a science of understanding epidemiological drug trends, especially as they pertain to, I mean, you could do it alone with just different waves of the opioid epidemic. And I know there are people doing that, but really good points. Yeah.
And one other thing I want to mention is, you know, I'm in the preclinical addiction neuroscience space, and that can be, it can be hard for me in that space to always translate and understand what clinicians and clinical researchers are doing and experiencing. And I think that if we stay in these silos, you know, running experiments without thinking about the clinical trends and experiences, you know, we haven't really been that successful in developing treatments from that neuroscience space. And so I think if we want to be more successful, if we could do a better job of talking with the clinical individuals and understanding clinical experiences and focusing our models a little bit more on that, that potentially we could go a little further.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the same for, I mean, we're both, you know, therapists, and I think the same thing is true for us. Every time I hear discuss, you know, talks on this, or I have conversations with people who are more involved in preclinical, even human laboratory spaces. I just learn so much, you know, about the drugs themselves, but also patient experiences, because we are talking to patients, but you know, you all have numbers as well, on that. And so, I completely agree with that. I appreciate your comments, and being willing to come talk to us, because this is
of
what
course.
We're doing, right? Yeah. Thank you so much, Cassie. This has been really enlightening, and we'll go ahead and we'll move to the take homes now, if that's okay with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what do you think the take home message would be for people who are in recovery or who are sort of thinking about making a change to their substance use?
For people in recovery, I would recommend having Narcan on hand if possible, because it's over the counter now. I would recommend if there are programs in your area for education about, you know, the drug supply and novel adulterants, that's something that might be good to not only learn about, but maybe disseminate as well to your communities.
Yeah.
There are also some resources out there already. There are groups who disseminate Narcan, right? There are groups that advocate for individuals with substance use disorder. And so getting active in those endeavors might be something, you know, of value and worthwhile to do. So, you know, those are the things I could see potentially saying.
I think those are great points, right? That, you know, and even people who've been in recovery a while, right? Like the drug supply changes rapidly, it seems like.
Right.
And so whatever you thought might be happening before might not be what's happening now. And so
right.
Be safe, get educated, get some reversal drugs if you got them.
Yeah.
They're over the counter now. What would you say to practitioners out there who might be listening?
One thing I would say is it's not one size fits all in terms of treatment. There are individuals who are xylazine exposed, but there may be individuals who are not. There may be individuals who don't have xylazine in their systems currently. And so, you know, keeping in mind individualized treatment and being open to, you know, new ways to track and test your patients for xylazine would be something just to always be mindful of. Also being aware of novel treatments that become FDA approved for use for this, just you know, be aware of current new drug treatments. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It also reminds me of something that people should be doing, but listening to your patients, because their
right.
experiences might not line up with what you've heard before, but things are changing out there.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah. What would your take-home message be for policymakers?
For policymakers, I think I've mentioned this kind of already, but, you know, one of the things that we struggle with for pushing our research forward, especially with this very rapidly evolving public health crisis, is funding, right? And so it's very, very hard to get these studies funded. And especially, like I mentioned, studies that focus on more than one system. But these drugs are not one system drugs. And so pushing forward, you know, funding opportunities and resources for all of this research, being more holistic in your goals in terms of finding, you know, mechanisms and treatments, I think would be really beneficial and helpful for the public health.
What would you say as a take-home message for underserved populations?
One thing I would say is for underserved populations, I think it's really important that if there are resources in your community, to utilize them. But I also acknowledge that we are severely lacking in many communities. And so I think that, you know, if there are opportunities to get Narcan from someone who is, you know, supplying them, there are groups out there that do that. I would say, I had an answer for this and now I can't think. of what it is. I don't know. I think that's all I want to say about it because I don't know what else to say.
Sounds good.
That sounded great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we really appreciate that. You know, this whole episode, it's really exciting to hear from, you know, the front lines of this issue, to hear the interesting work that you're doing. And we're really both, I think, really excited to see how it continues to develop. I guess not excited because this is not really a great issue. You know, it's not a good thing, but hopefully, you know, it's sort of cool to be a part of the group that's sort of fighting, you know, fighting back. So thank you so much for spending your time. We have one last question for you.
Sure.
And that is, you know, you've asked some really interesting questions over the course of your career and had a lot of success. Do you have any advice for trainees, early career people out there so they can do something similar?
Sure. So I think some of the key things that were that worked for me was persistence. This career is full of a lot of no's and criticism. And just finding a way to be comfortable in yourself and know that a rejection doesn't mean that you're bad at this, that you just have to reformulate or try something, maybe tweak it a little differently, and also expand your research portfolio. I may look a little, I guess, unfocused, if you would think that, because I do nicotine work, I do xylazine work, but I think that doing that keeps me very interested in what I do. Mm. And it also expands my expertise in ways that I find to be exciting. And that's why I still love my job, right? Is because I can come up with new ideas and do different things and do something I've never done before. And also talk to people who are outside of your field.
Yeah.
Because that can open up all new ideas, right? Whole new lines of research that no one else could do besides you and that person, for example. And so those are the things. I think persistence is really, really important. And I guess, I think that's really the main thing is because it's just a bunch of rejection, right?
Just rejection and persistence. Those
yeah.
The ones who are still there at the end, you know.
Oh, I guess I would also say, as you are planning your career, find more senior people you can trust and who really do have your best interests at heart and can help you navigate some of these really challenging career obstacles, right? And so I just think that that's a really important thing. That always helped me, was having people along the way who believed in me and I could trust and I could bounce ideas off of in terms of, you know, which decision I should make in different things. So I think that's an important thing as well.
Yeah, great point.
Well, thank you so much, Cassie. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. It's been really enlightening. Thank you so much for carving some time out for us and for our audience.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.